WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Some of mine. Him work will never disappear. Him was a brown man who fight for the black cause. He may help liberate Zimbabwe. He make Manley and Siaga shake hand. Him spend him life living where him believe. Him live for peace with the power of Emperor Elizabeth the First. And in spite of many threats of violence, him dead in a Miami away from the violence. Him words was clear to everyone. Now we listen to him songs, like hymns we sing them, like psalms we repeat them. Marley gone, Awem gone, Marley never left, him in our hearts and our minds.
Module, manle ak siga, dum yep de fko met chingam. Doch jamu jitel slase pingam, net jigun kote, ay vital, takul mutam, miami la kuyal mome, jif kutan ni manta fibre, wak kutan ni manta banya pen, dinam yep, yegin away and you.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Ruben Notice Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from the not-so-great white north here in Toronto, Canada. I am the bluesologist based in Toronto, and we came out of the box tonight with the music of Yusu Indoor featuring Muta Baruka, and he did a piece called Marley. And Yusu Indoor is coming to Toronto on November the 13th. He will be here at Kerner Hall, and I will be there to check my brother out. And we would like to thank two people like we thank every week. I would like to thank Chairman Omali Ishitela, the chair of the African People's Socialist Party and the African Socialist International. He gave me the space to do Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. And I would like to thank Archie Shep, the guy who gave me the concept of Diasporic Music, music made in the West, but not of the West. And O'Malley Shatella always reminds us that while we are of Africa, we are not in Africa. And we have great shows on we have great shows on Uhuru Radio. We have Ron Bob Simple with Caribbean Forum, Great Moments in African History. And we have Africa Live with Ron Bob Simple. Also, we have Reparations in Action with the host is James Simpson. We have Diasporic Music, which you're listening to now. Revolutionary Health and Fitness, a Golden Sunday Sounds, once again with Ron Bob Simple, Black Agenda Report. And we have a show from Europe, which I don't see. Oh, here, I messed it up. Report from Africans in Sweden and throughout Europe. I have to include the sisters from Sweden doing a great job on Uhuru Radio. And right now we wanted to get straight to our music and listen to a song that I used to listen to when I was a young man. I was, of course, raised on the blues and rhythm and blues, but I got into what they some people call jazz. And one of my favorite songs of all times is called Forest Flower Sunrise, Forest Flower Sunset, and we're going to listen to it right now with Chico Hamilton on drums. Thank you.
Thank you. Uhuru Radio.
Black power in black community.
And we're calling on all Africans. We recognize that as a people, we have tremendous skills in our community.
Informative.
So we've got to take all the skills that we've learned. You know, we've got to take all of our energy and we've got to find a way to contribute to making sure that African people have a future.
No degrading lyrics.
Africa is the future. Africa is the future.
There ain't no future unless we build it now.
Finally, the station you've been looking for. Uhuru Radio.
Come, join us on the 2015 Marcus Garvey Legacy Cruise, a fun-filled, African-centered cruise aboard the Carnival Splendor, departing from the port of Miami, Florida, making stops in Cozumel, Belize, Honduras, and the Cayman Islands. With the unique perspective and insight of Omali Yekshitela, chairman of the African Socialist International, we invite Africans everywhere, as well as friends and allies, to share in this amazing experience of African culture, history, great food, and friendship, all on a relaxing cruise for 8 days from November 29th to December 6th, 2015. For more details and reservations for the 2015 Marcus Garvey Legacy Cruise, call our exclusive agency, Tanya's Travel, at 352-693-3034. You may also log on to yahoolegacycruise.org to view the itinerary and pricing information. Call today, because procrastination is the thief of time. The 2015 Marcus Garvey Legacy Cruise, setting sail November 29th through December 6th. Call Tanya's Travel at 352-693-3034. That's 352-693-3034. Or log on to yahoolegacycruise.org and we'll see you on the open sea.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Toronto, Canada, and we were listening to Chico Hamilton on drums, and that was from an album called Man from Two Worlds. It featured the great Charles Lloyd on tenor saxophone. Charles Lloyd, still in the land of the living, from Memphis, Tennessee. We also heard Gabor Szabó on guitar. Gabor Szabó was born in Budapest, Hungary, and you might know him because he re-recorded Breezin' by Bobby Womack. That was probably his biggest hit. And also featured on this track is the late, great Albert Stinson, a young man that was born in Cleveland, 1944, and he joined the Ancestors on 1969. And we have a treat for you. We have two selections from Ayanna Gregory. She is the daughter of the comedian Dick Gregory. And she's going to give us a song for you. I think that's Leon Russell's song. And Wake Up Everybody, we know that song was made famous by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes featuring Theodore Pendergrass. But let's listen to Ayanna Gregory, the daughter of the comedian Dick Gregory.
So many places in my life and time. I've sung a lot of songs. I made some bad rhymes. I've acted out my life in stages with 10,000 people watching. But we're alone now. and I'm singing this song to you. I know your image of me is what I hope to be. I've treated you unkindly, but darling, can't you see? There's no one more important to me. Baby, can't you see through me? 'Cause we're alone now, and I'm singing this song to you. You taught me precious secrets of a true love, withholding nothing. You came out in front when I was hiding. Now I'm so much better, and if my words don't come together, listen to the melody, 'cause my love is in there hiding. Space of time. I love you for my life. You're a friend of mine. And when my life is over, remember when we were together. We were alone. And I was singing this song to you.
Busayo, give me a beat. No, not that one. You know the one I'm talking about, the one you did. Yeah, yeah, just like that. Like a boom, but the clack, clack, a boom, clack.
Wake up, wake up, wake up. Wake up, wake up, wake up, yeah. Wake up, wake up, wake up, yeah. Everybody, yeah, yeah, here we go. Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There is so much hatred, war and poverty. Wake up,
all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then we'll listen to what you have to say. 'Cause we're the ones who are coming up. The world is in our hands. When you teach the children, teach us the very best you can. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. And me. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Mm-hmm. Wake up, y'all. Wake up on a builder's time to build a new land. Know we can do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out 'cause they do it every time. Wake up all the thinkers, time to reclaim your mind. No more trying to fit in, we want freedom this time. For me to love and help the world, I have to love myself. I know that I'm beautiful and it's my story to tell. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Yeah, yeah, yeah. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, just you and me.
Uhuru, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, the bluesologist, the Bama, based in Toronto, Canada. And joining me on the line from Oakland, California, is Ishmael Reed, a prize-winning essayist, novelist, poet, and playwright. And he also has he's also a singer. I haven't got a copy of the CD. I would like to get a copy of the CD, but I would like to welcome Ishmael Reed to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. How are you doing, my good friend?
How are you doing, Norman? And incidentally, I play piano. Nobody wants to hear me sing.
You can sing better than Bob Dylan.
Oh, that's low, like a low bar.
No. I'm not. I mean, Bob Dylan is selling records, and I guess he's great. I guess he wrote some great songs. But first of all, I wanted to congratulate you for. Go ahead. I cut you off.
I said, I wish he stopped singing the blues.
We can talk about that another time. I would like to congratulate you on the complete Muhammad Ali. It looks like you did a wealth of research. I see you got Marvin X and Harry Belafonte. Hugh Masekela, Rahman Ali, and Ajib Bilal, everybody is in this particular book.
Yes.
How many years did it take you to put this book together?
I began the book in 2003.
Mm-hmm.
I was requested by Shay Earhart, who worked with Jacqueline Kennedy at Doubleday, to write a book about Muhammad Ali. She was fired, so the book was an orphan at Crown Publishers. They tried to, you know, revamp the book, which would include my autobiography and Muhammad Ali's biography, that there would be a mix of genres, and that didn't work. And so after the book reverted to me, and I got Robin Philpott up in Montreal.
Montreal, Canada, right, Quebec.
Yes, to publish the book. Because I had published him before. I had published some of his essays on Rwanda in my magazine. He published two books of essays, one Barack Obama and the Jim Crow Media.
Yes, I have. I'm looking at that right now.
The American media was sort of like a white power government in exile.
Right.
and the second book was Going Too Far.
Right.
And then I approached him about publishing the Ali book, and he published it. And he did a good job.
I concur with that. I wanted to ask you some side questions. Now, you were born in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and you grew up in Buffalo, New York. And I believe Chattanooga, Tennessee is the birthplace of Willie Ricks. I think he calls himself Mukasa Dada now. And his son, I think, recently graduated from medical school in Cuba. But he's known for hollering Black Power. He and Stokely Carmichael, it's a big debate. But Stokely always gets credit. But I think Willie Ricks had a lot to do with that. And you also grew up in Buffalo, New York. In Buffalo, New York, for some strange reason, has to be the most, has produced more DJs than any other city on the planet Earth. Frankie Crocker, Gary Imhotep Bird, a good friend of mine named Carol Blackman, her mother used to cook some great banana pudding. All of them came out of Buffalo, New York. Mm-hmm. What's in the water in Buffalo?
Yeah. Aretha Franklin, too, came out of Buffalo.
Aretha Buffalo, yeah. Oh, yes, she did. She came out of Buffalo. Her mother lived there until I think she passed away in Buffalo, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So I just wanted you to get your thoughts on, why Buffalo has produced so many radio personalities. Is there any reason for that?
Well, maybe it's because we're close to Canada. You can always go over to the border. That's what I write in this book, is that we felt that white Canadians were more tolerant than the people we had to face in down here in the United States. Of course, that was romanticizing Canada.
It has a lot to do with the fact that there were, until recently, not that many people of color in Canada. Yeah. It's changing now.
In the 1850s, Benjamin Drew, who was a fugitive slave or escaped his captors, compiled an anthology of fugitive slaves in Canada. Among them was Harriet Tubman. And I see myself as following that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I say things in Canada that I can't say here in the United States. Although the black media and the Muslim media have been very supportive of this book, it has not received a single mainstream review. Not a single review, not a single mainstream review.
So no Washington Post, no New York Times, no Wall Street Journal, none of that.
They sort of like my romance with American critics, and a lot of them are limited by their Eurocentric view of the world, which I compare to being a big chicken in a small cage. You know how they breed those chickens that are unhealthy?
Right.
I've been to Europe many times, beginning when I was 17, and I've noticed that the Europe that they romanticize is not the Europe that I've traveled in, most recently a few months ago. So they are not really capable of dealing with other points of view because of white supremacy. They know it all. And so what they do is designate tokens. And so from the 1920s at least, and maybe even during the abolitionist period, tokens have been selected by powerful entities up to the day. And their choices are sort of like trickle down, where black intellectuals and others and academics are so pleased that white people give a person recognition that they just go along with the program. So I have tried to challenged tokenism since the 1960s when I lived in New York. And when I was selected as a token, I told them that there are black writers who are just as good or better than I was. Which I didn't
so yeah, they basically just take one of us at a time, right?
Oh, absolutely, of course. I mean, it smothers black literature. It smothers the attempts of, especially the younger generation, of getting their voices heard. So what they do is they choose one token, and this token usually enters mainstream acceptance by catering to a powerful, you know, what you call mainstream audience. So in the 1930s and 40s, it was the Communist Party. And when Richard Wright and Chester Himes defied the Communist Party, they had to go in exile. Their careers were ended here. And right now it's feminism. It's white middle-class feminism that selects the trends in the black literary community. And Bell Hooks, who's outspoken, who can't be controlled, and who's unpredictable, said that white feminists told her that in order for her to succeed, she had to write for them.
Uh-huh. She said that publicly?
Absolutely. She wrote it. She said in the book.
Uh-huh.
She also said there was a double standard by the way the white feminist establishment treats black men and white men. They sort of kiss up the white men while they scapegoat black men. And I've gotten into a lot of trouble for expressing that point of view, too.
Oh, I know. But I wanted to ask you a few questions about this book. You talk about the Ali scribes on the one hand, the people that just idolize Muhammad Ali, and you also talk about his critics. And I guess maybe his biggest critic probably was George Jackson. I mean, George Jackson talked about Ali. He talked about Bill Cosby and so on and so forth. Could you talk about the scribes as well as his critics?
See, the scribes are fans, and they sort of duplicate each other and just have a view of Ali that's not reasonable. I try to go down the middle. I interviewed people with different points of view. Some were critics, and some idolized him. I even talked to some of his childhood friends in Louisville,
Kentucky.
Now, the black nationalists, including Hakeem Nadabudi and others, will never forgive him for turning his back on Malcolm X.
Right.
Black nationalists are never reviewed or interviewed in these books. They're white sports writers who interview each other or quote each other, and as I said in one sentence, even compliment each other on their clothing. So there are a lot of myths about Ali, and these stem from the hero worship that affects what I call the Ali scribes. Now, Michael Ezra, whom I met the other day, who gave me an endorsement for the book, is quite different, and his book was very instructive to me. For example, the showdown in Canada that I talk about in the book, where the Nation of Islam attempted to enter the boxing business through a franchise called Main Bouts, and they ran up against the mafia. And it's very interesting.
That was a fight between Ali and George Chavallo?
Well, it was a fight between
Ernie Terrell.
Ali and Ernie Terrell, who was supposed to be the
mob's
fighter.
Right.
And somebody from the mob went and told Herbert Muhammad that if a guy named Glickman, that if Ali didn't lose the fight, he'd end up at the bottom of Lake Michigan.
Right.
According to George Chavallo, who was an excellent heavyweight fighter, man, a tough guy.
Never been knocked down.
According to Chavallo, some of his Herbert Muhammad's aides, the Fruit of Islam, paid a visit to this guy and beat him so badly that he ended up in the hospital and finally in an asylum. So that was the first time that the organized crime and the Nation of Islam clashed. For example, Ali's name came up in a government wiretap of a crime family in New Jersey. The Nation of Islam sent a message to them that if anything happened to Ali, they would come out there, kill all the members of their families, and then go to the Waldorf Astoria and throw Frank Sinatra out of the window. So, I mean, people never encountered a group like this, the Nation of Islam, all the way back to Detroit, where they used to fight the police in court appearances whom they accused of insulting their women. So this is one of the reasons that the book is being ignored here, is because I try to give a more nuanced point of view, a view of the Nation of Islam.
I'm speaking with Ishmael Reed, the author of The Complete Muhammad Ali. Now, I grew up in Los Angeles, California, and they had Temple Number 27. And I also attended the mosque I've been to the mosque in Harlem and heard Minister Louis Farrakhan speak right after Malcolm died. And I lived in Cleveland for a second. And I went there, and my family were on my father's side. Many of them were members of the Nation of Islam, and they kept us away from them. I didn't meet them until I was in my late teens. Now, Elijah Muhammad you talk about Elijah Muhammad. He's a very controversial man, and my family was split on him. You know, my father thought he was just another Baptist preacher, and I had a nephew who joined the Nation and was in it from the time he was from 17 to 20, and I was a deep, deep, deep sympathizer. But could you talk about Elijah Muhammad and what I just said? Because I know you talk about how Elijah Muhammad has been really demonized by certain elements of the press.
Well, not only the press, you know, in a book called Race Matters, the intention of the secret government that gave us COINTELPRO,
yes,
was to cast him as some sort of a racketeer or a buffoon. And
right.
They manipulated the feud between Chicago and New York, between Elijah Muhammad's people and the people in New York who were following Malcolm. So you have to keep that in mind. But, you know, I hadn't gone into their business enterprises. And, you know, they had farms and they raised cattle and chickens and had international trade agreements. And it showed what could happen if you had a, you know, tightly knit, disciplined organization that could succeed in business.
What countries were they? Did they have business? What countries were they working with?
They had a fishing deal with one of the Asian countries.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to start a business in the Bahamas, and that was sabotaged, according to Andy Young, by the secret government and also by the Castro government. So the Castro government said that if they succeeded in this fishing deal in the Bahamas, they would blow up their ships.
That sounds like some kind of anti-communism, though, don't you think?
Well, I mean, you know, people sort of abandon their ideology when it comes to money. So they were sabotaged, you know, like their farms, the cattle, you know, were sabotaged by white racists.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, they were able to bring in, say, $70 million in revenue.
Right.
At least in 1 year. And were able to thrive. Now, Elijah Muhammad knew that he was not preaching the true Islam. And I have a interview with Sam Hamoud, whose father was the head of the Orthodox Islam group, one of the heads of the Orthodox Islam group in Chicago, and would instruct Elijah Muhammad, according to Sam Hamoud. And Elijah Muhammad said, well, you know, teach this to my sons. So he was not aware. He was aware. Now, I interviewed somebody who followed Wallace. Wallace Muhammad succeeded Elijah Muhammad in Louisville. And he said that they could
not. Was that Ajid Bilal?
No, not Bilal. Bilal was very instrumental in leading me to people like Herbert Muhammad and others.
Okay.
Excuse me. This was Attar, who was a follower of Wallace Muhammad, who told me that they felt they couldn't recruit the they couldn't recruit the masses of people with the Quran. They had to use popular culture. And so I talk about how, Muhammad Ali's cultural references were from popular culture, like comic books and, you know, movies, stuff like that. So they had to use this idea of the flying saucer and all these other things, and Yaqub, you know, that are scientists.
The big head scientist, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, but see, at the same time, more than one person told me that Elijah Muhammad had white people at his dinner table. And one of his friends was this guy named Cup, who had a TV show. So he was a pragmatist. Yet some of the artists and intellectuals in New York went along with some of this stuff, like Amiri, before Amiri became a communist. During one period, he had done a play called Black Mass about this idea of Yaqub creating white people. And I saw the play.
I saw it in New York. I saw it in Harlem in the Sun Ra was doing music. That was in the 60s, right? Early 60s.
This is when he left Harlem and was playing on Spirit House in Newark. I had a newspaper out there for a while. And I went and you know, Amiri had a devastating wit and also often used comedy to make serious points.
Yes, he did.
This play was hilarious. I saw this play. Also, he had a play called Jello. And the guy who played the role of, who played Jack Benny, I believe. What's the guy? Moving on up, that series on TV?
Jefferson, yeah.
Yeah, well,
he played Jefferson, yeah.
Yeah, but he originally was played in a play in Newark.
Jello. Mm-hmm.
So, Baraka was also adept at using popular culture. So, the Nation of Islam used popular culture.
I don't want to cut you, but I wanted to say I used to go. Like I said, I went to Mosque 27, and they had a minister named John Shabazz. I think he's still alive. He calls himself Abdul Allah Muhammad today, but I think he's up there. But he used to preach Ain't That Peculiar. You know, you would take a song, a popular song, and that would be his sermon that day.
Yeah,
he would use jazz references and Miles Davis, and he would make fun of Europeans for talking about Miles Coltrane or John Davis, you know, you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, so that was showed that he was more complicated than. I interviewed Jack Newfield, who's a great guy, the late Jack Newfield. And incidentally, about half the people I interviewed are dead. And some of them were concerned about Muhammad Ali's health, and he's still on his feet. But anyway, I interviewed Jack Newfield, who's a reasonable person, and he dismissed Elijah Muhammad as a cult racketeer. But when he died, he got these, he was on a show called Black Journal. Remember that show?
Yeah, Tony Brown. Tony Brown or the other guy used to,
Tony Brown's show.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, when I go to Washington, I get treated like a prince. Well, the government finally found out that these guys essentially were conservative.
Yes, right.
And so I asked one of the followers, what was the difference between them and Martin Luther King? They were non-confrontational. Martin Luther King, who came down in the 1960s as a sellout or someone who's using nonviolence, put his life on the line every day. He could be physically injured every day, and he's finally murdered. So, this is something for people to think about, because the conflict between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad for a while, I think he brought him back into the Nation, but for a while the conflict was about Malcolm X's remark about JFK. He was...
Chickens coming home to roost, that famous statement, yeah.
Yeah, he was expelled by Elijah Muhammad, because Elijah Muhammad did not want confrontation with powerful forces of the government, or, you know, be retaliated upon by powerful forces. He felt that Malcolm X was putting the nation in jeopardy. So, you know, he suspended him in this this editorial in Muhammad Speaks. Now, a lot of people are shocked when I talk about Muhammad Ali moving to the right.
Yes.
He endorsed Ronald Reagan and accepted a prize or an award or tribute from George Bush. People are surprised to hear that. Now, Khalilah Muhammad, a.k.a. Belinda, who was
his second wife?
Yes. She said that this is because he's been being manipulated by his third wife. Oh, excuse me, fourth wife.
That's Lonnie, right?
Yeah, Lonnie, who in my book is either a gold digger or a saint. Harry Belafonte says that she was a stabilizing force in his life, but his friends in Louisville, including his brother, have a different point of view about her, seeing that she's out for the money. So Khalilah Muhammad says that he's being steered into this rightward direction by Lonnie Ali. And she can be pretty autocratic. Well, I don't know if autocratic. You know, she likes to be in control, because Thomas Hauser, who wrote the official biography under her direction and supervision, tried to get an essay in this big old book called GOAT. I think it's still selling for $3,000. GOAT. He tried to
get greatest of all.
Yeah, the greatest of all time. He tried to get an essay criticizing Muhammad Ali for not taking a stand on the war in Iraq, and she rejected the essay. But now I think he's back, and he was very bitter. I talked to him on the phone, and he was very upset about her doing this, and told me that he's being manipulated by her and his agent. And yet he's got a book coming out next year called A Tribute to Muhammad Ali, and I think that's probably a reaction to my book.
I hate to say this, but we only have a few minutes. It's the time has basically run out, and I would basically like to encourage everyone to pick up a copy of The Complete Muhammad Ali. And is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, you know, it's doing very well in Canada, so I think thank all of the Canadian readers, because it wavers between number one and number two on Amazon in Canada. That's not the case here in the United States, where the book is being ignored. But, you know, I have a remedy for that. I've learned different languages, and I've gone to China, and they're translating all my books. So I think the advice to a young writer is that you can escape the token one at a time designation by learning different languages, African, Asian.
So you can speak a little Yoruba, and you can do, if Ni Hao, that's Chinese, that's Mandarin, isn't it?
I can say Inumidu. Say, you know, how do you feel? I say, well, if you taste me, you taste sugar. You do, we do. Anyway, you know, I had a great trip to Nigeria, and I mean, found a lot of good writers over there whom I published.
All right, sir, and thank you very much. And I'd like to bring you back if possible and continue this discussion about Ali and your other work.
Well, thank you very much, Norman. I appreciate it.
All right, and we have been speaking with Ishmael Reed of Oakland, California, and Diasporic Music continues on Uhuru Radio.
You're listening to uhururadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Nanga Def, the language that they speak in, it's a Wolof language, but they speak Wolof in Senegal, Gambia, and Wolof people are all around the world. That is the greetings in Wolof, great language spoken by Yusu Ndour.
And we are going to play some music now from the Cape Verde Islands. And many people came from the Cape Verde Islands. I guess we're going to listen to Sarah Tavares from Cape Verde, from the Cape Verde Islands. And this is Sarah Tavares.
Diga que é momento que espera te. Tanto rogar pra Deus, tanto pedir pra céu. Momento que vos olhos te encontra com de meu. Já credo teu, colar a mim. Vem cá o xin de medo, desse thank you.
Alafio, you are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. You're speaking. My name is Norman Otis Richmond. I am the bluesologist, the Bama, based in Toronto, Canada, and we're getting ready to listen to some music from Tavares, a group called Tavares, and they are from the United States, but their roots are from the Cape Verde Islands, and we're also going to listen to a man named Horace Silver. Horace Silver is born in the United States, and his roots are from the Cape Verde Islands, and Tavares is going to perform a song called The Night of Cousin Pete. That was from the pen of Jesse Belvin, Jesse and Joanne Belvin from Los Angeles, California. And Good Night, My Love has been recorded by many, many people, including Paul Anka. And Horace Silver is from the Cape Verde Islands, and the song called Song for My Father was written for his father, who was from the Cape Verde Islands, and it features Mr. Silver on piano, Carmel Jones on trumpet, Joe Henderson on tenor saxophone, Teddy Smith on bass, Roger Humphreys on drums, and let's listen to Tavares, and then we'll hear a little bit of Horace Silver.
Please give your love. sunny and bright, and draw you closer to me.
Closer.
Uhuru Radio.
Black power in black community.
McKinney Clemente up in the Green Party. No disrespect, we need a red, black, and green party.
Informative.
How wealth gets redistributed is that the workers themselves come to power. The workers come to power, and then we redistribute the wealth, not the petty bourgeoisie.
No degrading lyrics. Finally, the station you've been looking for. Uhuru Radio.
Uhuru, I am Mayembe Malaika. I support Burning Spear Media and Norman Otis Richmond. Will you? Burning Spear Media keeps alive African culture from North America, the Caribbean, Africa, and the world. We have not forgotten Patrice Emery Lumumba, Joseph Okito, and Maurice Mbolo. Burning Spear Media keeps them alive. Uhuru News and Radio connects African people worldwide. Burning Spear Media is owned and controlled by the African working class. Yes, bless you.
Good things, gotta back up, get ready, fulfill the task, good things.
Information, ideas, reality. That's what the Burning Spear newspaper offers you each month. Truth about government, society, entertainment, and the world around you. The Burning Spear is the oldest Black Power newspaper in existence, and your one-year subscription is only $25. Get the insight and perspective that the mass media machine cannot and will not deliver. Read dynamic articles on the most pressing issues affecting the lives of African workers in the U.S., Africa, and around the world. Each month, you'll find real political analysis of the crisis of parasitic capitalism, insight into world and local events, and a focus on the realities and struggles in the heart of the hood, expressing the vision and voice of the African working class. Uncompromising truth, unwavering focus. The Burning Spear newspaper. This is Black Power in the 21st century. Subscribe today and don't get fooled again. Order your subscription now. Go to burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. That's burningspearmarketplace.com and click on Spear. Uhuru.
Thank you.
And we are still playing music from the Cape Verde Islands, or from Cape Verde. And once upon a time, Cape Verde was part of the, it was part of Burkina Faso and the Cape Verde Islands, and imperialism and colonialism divided them, just like imperialism and colonialism divided Africa into 53, 54 states, whatever we have now. But at one time, Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde was supposedly one country. Then the imperialists split it into Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde. One of the greatest people from the Cape Verde Islands was Amilcar Cabral. He was born in the Cape Verde Islands. And one of the other well-known people, I don't know how great he was Sweet Daddy Grace. And Sweet Daddy Grace was a very controversial man. He was born in the Cape Verde Islands. Do a Google search and check out Father Divine. I keep on getting him mixed up with Father Divine, but I'm talking about Sweet Daddy Grace. He was from the Cape Verde Islands. But we're getting ready to listen to a song from Cesaria Evora, and she's going to be singing about Angola. Now, the Portuguese colonized Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau, and the Cape Verde Islands, Brazil, and Goa. And I probably have missed something, but you are all students of history, or many of you are students of history, and do a little homework and find out who else the Portuguese colonized. But Brazil was their big prize, and Brazil was in the Western Hemisphere because the Pope made a decision that instead of the Spanish and the Portuguese fighting one another, the Portuguese would get Brazil, and then Spain would get the rest of the Western Hemisphere. Hence, the Spanish had got Cuba, Puerto Rico, Chile, Spain, and so on and so forth, with the exception of, a few people got, the Dutch got a few islands, ABC Islands, and Suriname, and so on and so forth. But the Cape Verde Islands, not Cape Verde, the Angola is going to be sung by Sister Evora, but this is Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio.
Vida sabias de viver, parada de not machê, sem macama com sabura. Es vida sabias de viver, parada de not machê, sem macama com sabura. Angola, Angola, e força, a minha escata mata, o meu coar para minha caminho. Angola, Angola, e força. Minhos catamatan, o meu cuar pambanha caminho. Es convivência, desminhos vivência, paciência de um consequência, resistência de um extravagância. Es convivência, desminhos vivência, paciência de um consequência, resistência de um extravagância. Angola, Angola, e força, a minhos catamatan. Menguara pambanha caminho. Angola, Angola, e força. Pra mim, os catamatanhos. Menguara pambanha caminho.
Angola, Angola, oi, que poça, paninha os catamatana, vem com hora para banhar caminho. Angola, Angola, oi, poça, paninha os catamatana, vem com hora para banhar caminho. Es convivência, des minhas vivência, paciência de consequência, resistência de extravagância. Es convivência, des minhas vivência, paciência de consequência, resistência de extravagância. Angola, Angola, oi, moça, a minha oscata matando, vem com hora para banhar caminho. Angola, Angola, oi, moça, a minha oscata matando, vem com hora para banhar caminho. Angola, Angola, oi, moça, a minha oscata matando, vem com hora para banhar caminho. Angola, Angola, oi, moça, a minha oscata matando, vem com hora para banhar caminho. Angola, Angola, oi, moça, a minha oscata matando, vem com hora para banhar caminho. Angola, Angola, oi, moça, a minha oscata matando, vem com hora para banhar caminho.
Uhuru Radio.
Our revolutionary aspirations could contend with the ruling class in this war of ideas.
No degrading lyrics.
There was a video game to teach your ancestor name.
Informative.
We welcome anybody who is about the liberation and freedom of African people, and this is a part and parcel of that liberation and freedom struggle.
Finally, the station you've been looking for. Uhuru Radio.
Hey, Aisha, hold on. I'll walk with you. You know, this is going to be a great class.
I know. Yet I'm still trying to figure out how I can exactly use these skills.
The Uhuru Movement.
The Uhuru Movement?
Yes, the Uhuru Movement. They offer great opportunities to utilize these type of skills in the most meaningful ways. I mean, writers, photography, graphic design, journalism, videography, video editing, even radio broadcasting.
Wow, sounds great. I'm assuming you have to be pretty advanced.
Not at all. I mean, although experienced is welcome, it's not mandatory. You know, the Uhuru Movement, they will train you. Log on and sign up today at uhurunews.com, where your skills are wanted and needed. Whether reporting on local news, writing for an international newspaper, or hosting your own radio show, the Uhuru Movement is the place for you. Do you have a desire to work in sales, marketing, or administration? Do you have the talent for audio engineering? Log on and sign up today, uhurunews.com. Not just explaining the world, but changing the world.
Thank you, brother. I will definitely follow up today.
And hopefully you'll become a member like I am.
Nangadef. Nangadef is Wolof. It's the language of the people of Senegal, the Gambia, and Mauritania. And my name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, and I'm joined on the line by Cecile Nokinge. And Cecile is a guitarist, songwriter, singer-songwriter, and she blends blues, Afro roots, and soul to create a unique sound. She was born and raised in New York City, and she is a first generation from the Cameroon. She has lived in the U.S. of A., France, and she now resides in Montreal, in Quebec. I'd like to welcome you to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. Cecile, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. Now, you're coming to Toronto to the Women in Blues Review, Massey Hall, yes, on November 28th. And Massey Hall is a historical venue.
say it was the greatest jazz concert ever. Some people disagree with that, but Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, Max Roach, Charles Mingus, and Dizzy Gillespie. So how did it feel to be playing in a venue like that?
You know, it's an honor because that concert I've been hearing about since I was a kid. Like, my pop was a huge jazz buff and he had the vinyl, and I've been dreaming about this place since then, because it's just a lot of legends played there, and to grace the same stage as a lot of greats, because the quintet you just mentioned is like five of the greatest jazz players, jazz cats. So it's quite an honor to experience the hall, and it's going to be a great time playing alongside some wonderful musicians and singers as well. So I'm really looking forward to the show.
Your CD is called Anybody Listening? Part one, monologues, correct?
Monologues, yes.
Could you talk about the CD? How did you come about recording? This is now you have recorded. This is not your first CD. Could you talk about this particular CD, though?
Sure. So this is my third album, third full length, and I wanted to get back to basics, get back to my roots as a guitarist and as a singer songwriter. I started playing on acoustic, and when I first decided to start a solo career 5 years ago, it was playing and singing solo on acoustic guitar. So it was really a way to get back to that, get back to the songs at their raw state. Take a break too from touring a rhythm section, because I've been touring the Power Trio for the last few years, and really just come back to the essence, right? So it's songs at their purest form, the playing and singing at its rawest form, and what that does is that it brings out it brings everything out that much more, right? So you actually pay attention to lyrics, because there's no extra clouding them. You pay attention to the performance, because there's no huge production around it. So it was really the idea to bring back what I do without any of the extra trimmings. And yes.
No, go ahead. No, go ahead. This is your interview. Let me shut up.
Yeah. And basically addressing themes that subjects that matter to me, right, or that I felt needed to be expressed, whether it's racism, whether it's homophobia, whether it's the fact that we're living at a time where we have the most access to information, the most access to being connected to people, and yet we're living some of the loneliest times that our species knows, and all that because we're being manipulated into this sort of glorification of the self, you know, where it's all about selfies, it's all about being superstars in our bubbles through social media, but not quite paying attention to what's going on around us, you know, and we get so caught up in being the center of the world that we forget that the world is happening outside of our bubble. We forget that governments are passing legislation that is that goes against our well-being simply because we're not paying attention to what it is that they're actually passing through law. You know, we can think of the Patriot Act in the States. We can think of Bill C-51 here. We can think of Bill 78 that was passed here in Quebec that basically got rid of our right to assembly. Like all sorts of legislature and social norms that are being imposed simply because we're not paying attention. So that's pretty much what the trilogy is about. It's about opening our eyes or being aware of what's going on outside of just our Facebook updates or Instagrams.
Well, I'm speaking with Cecile, and I wanted to ask you before, I wanted to get back to what you were talking about in terms of the content of and the role of music and culture.
But I have a question for you. As a person, I consider myself an African, and Africans are all over the world. But, you know, there's not really a debate, but do you think that blues began in Mississippi, or did blues begin on the African continent?
Well, what came first, the chicken or the egg? I'm not sure that blues as we know it would not have been possible without the meeting of cultures. Right. So without Africa being forced onto the States or vice versa, I don't think that we would have the sound that we have today, because it's very much traditional African sound that met the reality of slaves in the States. That's what created blues as we know it as a genre. So did it start in Africa? Yes, in terms of its roots, but it is an American sound. It is an American genre that melds to two continents. So I don't know how to answer the question other than that.
Well, you know that Ali Foucault Touré and John Lee Hooker are all there. They are always compared. You know, then I think they have the desert blues. I think these are some brothers and sisters, I believe, from Mali, I believe. So you know, some people say that there are some people, kind of conservative black folks, that say, you know, blues has nothing to do with Africa. We just landed in Mississippi and, you know, Georgia and started singing like that. But I don't necessarily believe that. But you sound go ahead, I'm going to cut you off.
No, I was just going to say, for those who think that it has nothing to do with Africa, go ahead and pick up some music, some traditional music from Mali, or from Guinea, or from any of the cultures that the slaves were taken from, and you will hear Mississippi, and you will hear Louisiana, and you will hear the South in there as well. You know, right. You will hear the hollers in the music. So I don't know. I think as much as blues is very much an American genre, and it should be proud to be an American genre. Just like jazz and rock and roll, et cetera. I mean, you can't cut where it comes from. Like, to say that Africa has nothing to do with the blues to me is absurd.
Yes. Well, let me ask you this. Politically and musically, I have always been fascinated with the Cameroon. At one time, when I started writing as a journalist, I used the name Mumia, after Felix Mumia of the UPC. And I always followed the UPC. When I say always, I was young, but I know the UPC was a political party in Cameroon. And before Guinea became independent, the French wiped out the UPC. I mean, I think they might have murdered two, maybe three. They took the whole Central Committee and executed them. So I knew politically about Cameroon, but also musically, we had Manto Dibango, and you know, he had a big universal hit, and then he did this Soul Makossa, and then he did it in reggae with Sly and Robbie, you just listening to you talk, you seem to be using music as a weapon to educate people about the social conditions of Africa in the world. Am I correct in saying that?
Not just Africa, but in, you know, the humans in general, right? And one thing
Africa in the world, yeah.
And as you know, one thing that I love about art, and especially music, is that it hits us in a wonderful way, right? Because you can not understand the lyrics and still be moved by the intent or the sentiment that's behind something. And we are more often than not open to hearing a song than we are into hearing a sermon or a speech, right? So
right.
I think that music is a wonderful medium to be able to try to vehicle some form of social message or some form of hope or commentary or whatever it is. I mean, one of my favorite bands is the Staple Singers, and they were a perfect example of how to bring some form of social awareness through song. You know, because people are actually more open to hearing the message that you have to say when it's accompanied by a rhythm or a harmony that they can love, you know, and that was the strength of gospel. It's the strength of gospel as well. It's the strength of all the protest songs from the 60s. I mean, Curtis Mayfield, he did wonders in melding groove and social commentary through his stuff. Same with Nina Simone and whatnot. So I think that, you know, as musicians and artists in general, we have a way of reaching people that is priceless, and people actually want to hear what we have to say. So it's, you know, it would be unfortunate to not use that platform to try to provoke some form of social awareness or try to be a part of the social change that I'd want to see.
I'm speaking with Cecile, and I wanted to ask you a question of who influenced you as an artist, who influenced you as a singer, who influenced you as a songwriter, and who influenced you as a guitarist.
I guess my first big influence as a guitarist and composer would be my brother Jason. He gave me my first guitar. He's the one who introduced me to all of the players that I fell in love with as a guitar player. So he's the one who gave me my first two blues tapes. It was a T-Bone Walker tape and a Freddie King tape that I totally used up just rewinding and learning all their solos and whatnot. Through my pop, there was Les Montgomery that I discovered, and Kenny Burrell. Charlie Christian, Freddie Green. So the jazz guitarist through my pop, and the blues guitarist through my brother, and then you had all the soul players, right? So you had the Nile Rodgers from Chic, and you had the Amicades from Earth, Wind. Like, so many influences, mostly from blues, soul, and jazz. Of course, there was all the Stax and Muscle Shoals rhythm sections that came into it too. So the, you know, the Croppers got in there, and the Guitar Murphys got in there and whatnot. Anything that I could get my hands on and ears on were an influence and still are. You know, Pop Staples is an influence. Not too many rockers, although I did check out Jimmy, but Jimmy to me is still more blues than rock.
Right. Right.
And as singers, it's funny because I haven't really shed any singers the same way that I've shed guitar players. Because for the longest time, I considered myself a guitarist more than anything. So as much as I always loved listening to singers, whether it was the Holidays or the Fitzgeralds or the Marvin Gayes or the Aretha Franklins or the Gladys Knights or the Mavis Staples and all of them, they weren't really influences per se. So I think that right now it's still a work in progress. I'm actually discovering or paying closer attention to singers now that I've started singing than before as a green musician, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the songwriting goes, again, so many influences. It's funny because more often than not, people compare me to Tracy Chapman, which I think we look nothing alike, but we do have one thing in common is that we do use our music to vehicle some form of social commentary, and she's definitely one of the singer songwriters that I love. Like, she's definitely in my top 10. So is Curtis. So is Donny Hathaway. So many, driven. I mean, Bob Dylan, even though he's wordy as hell, I love him as a songwriter because of what he's able to bring out of how he tells his story. Just so many wonderful artists that have influenced me in one form or another. And that keeps influencing.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, you talk about homophobia in your music, and you know, that whole question of homophobia in 2015. Those songs in particular, how are they received when you perform them in publicly?
Are you referring to Bloodstained Vodka? Or just in general?
In general.
You know what? It's the reception I get is pretty warm, all in all. I've yet to have played a gig where there wasn't an openness and good response to what I do. Some more conservative spots, people may have an issue in terms of subject matter. A lot of people don't like being called on their shortcomings, myself included, right? So if there are homophobes in the room or in the audience, they will be made uncomfortable by Bloodstained Vodka. So, you know, as far as my being queer, I don't really bring it to the stage in terms of a banner. Like, it's not about that to me. What I do bring to the stage is an unapologetic presentation of who I am. So say if I sing a love song, I'm going to sing it with female pronouns or whatnot to it, because that's my reality. I'm not imposing it on anybody. It's just I'm being true to myself, right? And as far mm-hmm. as people who might have an issue with homosexuality, it really has nothing to do with anybody other than people who want to screw, right? So it's my sexuality. I'm not bringing it to you in a predatorial or in a ulterior motive kind of way. I'm presenting it more in terms of, you know what, this is who I am, and it has nothing to do with you, but I'm singing a love song, so it's going to be about who I sing it to. Or in the case of Bloodstained Vodka, it's a matter of, you know what, how is it that you don't have an issue with somebody being beaten to a pulp or being raped as rehabilitation simply because you don't approve of who they screw? They're not trying to screw you. They're not trying to do anything to you. They're just trying to live their lives, you know, and have a relationship among consenting adults. So why the hell would you feel the need to hurt them in any kind of way or disrespect them in any kind of way over something that really truly does not affect you in any kind of way? So it's trying to bring perspective to things, because to me it's unimaginable that you can hate somebody for doing something that is not against you in any kind of way or yours, or, you know, it's just a reality that they have and that they're living outside of you. And you are willing to kill them, you know, or hate them or do harm to them simply for their pursuit of happiness that in no way harms you. You know, it's on the same level as hating somebody and lynching somebody because of how they look. It's the same thing, because really, truly, who somebody else is screwing as a consenting adult has no bearing whatsoever on your existence. So it's really trying to bring a certain form of understanding or tolerance or respect, you know, that is also protected by our rule of law, you know. So it's just trying to find a way for us to coexist in a peaceful manner, you know, and trying to bring the way that we can relate to each other back to what we have in common, as opposed to try to alienate hurt or hinder I'm trying to focus on the things that we can do in common to make life better than the differences that we choose to make life worse for each other. So that's really what I'm trying to do through the stage and through music. It's really more about where we unite rather than where we differ.
Do you remember when Huey Newton wrote his essay on arguing, telling people to not use? He was criticizing people. He was saying people should not harm people because of their sexual orientation, because it's today transgender people are being murdered, really. Do you remember that essay that you wrote?
Yeah, right now there is a serious issue with protecting trans populations, and I can think of the bathroom bill up here, and I believe that there's the same thing in the States, where there was a bill, I forget the number now up here, that was initially brought to Parliament to protect transgendered people from discrimination in terms of public spaces. You know, and that bill has been turned into an attack against our trans population to try to see them as their birth gender or birth sex, right? Which is, and the reasoning that they use to attack is that it'll do more harm to women to have transgendered women among cisgendered women, which is absurd, because really, if you really want to harm a woman in a public bathroom or anywhere, really, you know, you can be a straight man dressed up as a woman and harm them anyways. Like, really and truly, if we really want to do each other harm, we will find ways to circumvent the policies that are in place to protect, right? So as far as attacks on transgendered people, I don't see how somebody being transgendered is in any way threatening to anybody. Like honestly, like really and truly, what does it do to you? How are you harmed by seeing somebody trying to live the reality that will help them be what they believe to be the best of themselves? To be comfortable in the world. Like, really and truly, what does it do to you on an every kind of day level? Like, mm-hmm. when we really think about the relations that we have or the interactions that we have with people on a day-to-day basis, like, you take strangers, right? Like, what do we see? We see people, we meet people in grocery stores or in the library or wherever it is, and our interactions usually last anywhere from 30 seconds to maybe half an hour if you have something involved, right? But really and truly, what is that exchange on the most part? It's hello, how are you doing? I pay for something, you give me change, thank you very much, have a great day. Or any kind of, but it's true, on average, like you meet, how many people do you meet in a day? And really, the interactions that you have with them are no longer than really an exchange of pleasantries and a business transaction, and that's it. You know, so if you take that as the contact that you're going to have with somebody, really and truly, if that person is not threatening you in any kind of way, why would you bring animosity to that? Simply because you don't understand their reality, or because you personally do not embrace their ideology or their choices in terms of living their sexuality, or in terms of expressing who they are in terms of gender. Like, that really has nothing to do with you, and it really has no bearing in the success of the transaction that you're going to have with said person. You know, so really, we personally bring in so much negative energy and so much hatred into our interactions with other human beings that really has no bearing, no justification. You know,
we're almost out of time, but I have to ask you two final questions. One, what do you think about the election of Justin Trudeau, the Liberal Party, coming to power in Canada? And is there anything else you would like to add? We only have about 2 minutes left.
Sure. Well, I think that it's definitely a move up from the conservatives. The only thing that worries me is that the liberals and the conservatives did have a lot of common agendas as far as the economy. They just had different ways of going about the end result. So we'll see how much better we're off with the liberals in power as opposed to the conservatives. So I'll leave that at that. And I do hope that the White House stays blue next year.
And could you talk about where you're going to be on November 28th? Final thoughts.
28th, I will be, I'll be playing one of my bucket list venues, which is Massey Hall in Toronto, performing alongside some wonderful artists and instrumentalists. And we are going to have a great time, and hopefully we'll be able to get that much more past the novelty that is women instrumentalists, which unfortunately we still have a long way to go in terms of being seen as equals and being treated as equals in what is still a very much male industry. So I'm looking very forward to an extra step towards breaking the stereotype of women in music.
And thank you very much. And I will definitely, I'll be there with, as Johnny Moore said, we'll see, I'll be there with my red suit on.
Beautiful. Looking forward to it.
All right. Thank you very much. And we have been speaking with Cecile Dongay and Dongay Partner. Say that again.
Dokinge.
Not Dokinge.
Yes.
That's Dokinge. A beautiful name. It's a beautiful Dokinge. That's a beautiful name. And I would like to thank Lisa Watson for teching today. And as we say every week, we will see you in the whirlwind and come to Massey Hall and see Miss Dokinge.